Dear God. Internet, do you see the people I have to work with?
I'm not even drunk. At all.
I know.
Oh, it's been a weird day.
It has been.
Welcome to the podcast where your hosts sample a different scotch each season while we dive into current social, political, and economic issues each episode. This is Scotch and Socialism.
Sorry, I don't know why that was so funny. But yes, we are Scotch and Socialism.
We are something. We are high on life.
What are you this evening, Russ?
Oh God, I'm your malevolent dictator.
Your resident malevolent dictator.
There you go.
And as always, I'm Griff, your resident cynic.
And I'm Jake, your resident deontologist.
Deontologist.
Is it deontologist or deontologist?
I'm guessing deity is the base.
I'm not entirely certain with the full root, but
deontology. Where are we going with this?
I mean, we're talking about ethics tonight, right?
Fair.
So deontology.
Enlighten us a little bit.
Deontology is the idea that there is a universal code of ethics, effectively. So a one right singular way to do things.
Interesting.
Or moral law, I think, is that what it also is kind of explained as. It's Immanuel Kant. It was like the big name that's known for it.
Interesting.
Yep. Yeah.
Not what I would have expected.
No. I mean, I hear that root word and I think of deist belief systems.
Sure.
Which was apparently what the Founding Fathers kind of more or less believed in.
Depending on who you talk to, yeah.
Deontology, interesting. That was not a topic that we touched on in my philosophy classes that much.
Now, the next question, like, because there's a lot of Christians who would describe themselves. Most Christians wouldn't use the term deontology because most people don't know the term deontology. I had to look it back up because it's been 10 years since I took my ethics class. But, you know, the idea of a universal moral framework that's outside of human control, I suppose, is how I would best describe it.
How does that manifest itself within Christianity?
God being the ultimate moral authority, effectively.
Okay, fair.
But it poses an interesting question, one which I don't have the answer to, also partly because I'm not certain that I'm completely a deontologist. I don't know what I am.
He's a casual deontologist, yeah, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm a cultural deontologist.
Oh, gosh. That sounds like something you get a PhD in.
Yeah, a little bit. So it begs the question, like, if you believe in God, not even necessarily the Christian God, but if you believe in an ultimate
higher authority.
Being, higher authority or whatever.
So I'm hearing agnostic?
Huh?
So I'm hearing agnostic?
Not necessarily. We can touch that later.
Sure.
Sure. Did that higher being/beings create the moral ethical law? Or was the moral ethical law pre-existent?
Ah. Is that kind of like the question, like, if God could microwave a burrito, could he microwave a burrito so hot, not even he could eat it?
Potentially. I love that turn. Really, I love that turn on the whole really lifting a rock thing. I've not heard it expressed like
really
that.
Really going for the low-hanging fruit.
No, oh, but man. I mean, bring it back to it purely like a more Christian perspective, which I'm just much, much more attuned to, is like, you know, if moral law somehow predates God, then that poses some really weird questions. Like, God is not the ultimate authority.
Where did it come from?
Yeah. Right. And where did it come from? Or if God created moral law, that seems rather arbitrary, which, I mean, we could get into questions of the three goods problem, which is a whole other topic that we can get into.
We're flirting dangerously close to the edge of a very deep conversational chasm.
Oh, hilarious.
Here.
Like, you guys brought up ethics, and so this is where I've got.
Did you not hear my intro? Light and simple.
I thought you were being facetious.
No, that's our other podcast.
Where we drink spritzes.
Where we drink wine coolers and talk about pop culture. I would love to talk about pop culture one day on this.
Later.
I mean, I really want to do an episode on Lil Nas.
Is it later?
Later.
Agreed. I have strong opinions.
And it's just really fun to sit back and watch.
It's just
fun. I really don't care.
Well, and speaking into that, right, the whole anarchy of the thing, right? So anarchy is really a construct of legality, right? Or does it involve morality and ethics as well?
I mean, that's kind of the question of, like, can light exist without dark?
Exactly.
Well, I think that's different, though, because you can have okay, here we go. Because if you have an anarcho-based system of governance, you technically don't have a formal structure of government. However, you would still necessarily have to have some sort of underlying social framework.
Which would be the ethics likely. Of the social construct, right?
Right. And see, this is where it gets really tricky. Maybe pure anarchy doesn't exist, because even if you don't have a government, and that's kind of what we've written anarchy to supposedly profess, is that, you know, a lack of government or a lack of governing, a lack of
governmental structure. Is it a lack of government or is it a lack of laws?
That's a good question.
Because there's a fine difference there, right?
Yes, because, well...
What one is the body?
To an extent, yeah. Because if we perceive government to be the manifestation and authoritative body of those laws and the...
I think it's kind of the congruent grouping, right? Of
right.
all of the laws, right. the lawmakers.
And we could really get into common sense and Thomas Paine here. Great book, by the way. That's the thing is I don't think that a pure anarchic state could exist because I don't think such a thing is rhetorically possible.
In an anarchic state, you still have your own internal laws and potentially social groups that'll break off and form their own governance, right?
We live in a society.
Well, that's just it.
We live in a society. Hold on, let me put my Oakleys on.
Get a little too PC in here.
My Dodge,
no, but from a purely practical standpoint, I don't think that we would reach a state of anarchy.
No, we want governance. Humans in general. Right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, all animals, right? They all have some level of social structure.
Most
right.
do, yeah.
And it's one of those things that even in the complete chaos of everything, we're going to create our own. Whether it be small, you know, it may not be as large as the current governance that we exist today. But even like within our own lives, we have our own social structures. We have our own friend groupings. And each one of those has its own governance, right? It is its own set of, you know, not necessarily laws at that point, but that's where ethics kind of come in my opinion.
Well, I think evolutionarily we're programmed to do so, because if you think about how it's been established that we humans look for patterns and look for clearly definable divisions, basically.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying divisions that are negative connotation, but just we like things that are easy to define.
Well, we like to classify things, right?
Exactly.
I mean, look at everything that we've done in the scientific community. We classify everything.
We classify, absolutely. Even in a social aspect, you know, and we've made it extremely clear now with social media, but when you have a living being, humans, who have that genetically programmed into them, I think by necessity, it will lead to a structured societal framework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not that societal framework contributes to an overall good and health of that society,
that's where
we start getting into ethics versus morality.
Right. And like there's the idea of the social contract and a code of conduct between people. It's going to develop no matter what. I mean, just looking at it from a purely historical perspective, we've always, like, we as humans come together as tribes, then we come together as nation states, and so on and so forth. And so I think it's kind of a natural conclusion.
Well, it's beneficial, right? That's the entire idea of it.
It's mutually beneficial.
It's mutually beneficial because if I can hurt you and you can't hurt me, then I don't need you. But if you can hurt me and I can hurt you, well, that's a problem.
So you like the doctrine of mutually assured destruction?
Pretty much. I mean, that is what if we can't kill each other because there's some offset to my own self, my own safety, right?
Well, it's a fiduciary relationship.
Exactly. Or lack thereof because of, detriment.
Sure.
Either way, either it's positive or negative. But if it's net zero, then I don't need you. It's either beneficial to me because you're not hurting me, or it's beneficial to me because I'm getting something out of it. But that's kind of how all social contracts exist. And that's another topic that I'm sure we'll get into at some point, is there is no such thing as true altruism.
I think we could roll that into this tonight, but entirely appropriate for this topic.
Yeah. And so from your perspective, the social contract only really exists when there is the existence of threat?
Not necessarily threat, but also benefit. So okay. as long as it's not net zero.
I mean, that's what a contract is. If you look at a contract from, like, if you sign a contract with a cable company.
Sure. They get their
You both have a benefit, but you both have a consequence. Maybe consequence is a better term.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Because threat has some connotations, but consequence is just a fact of physical law, basically. You know, action. I don't pay my cable bill. Reaction, consequence, they cut off my service.
But at that point, you're back to net zero, right? It's not beneficial.
What do you mean?
Well, so the if someone didn't have cable, they're not going to get cable because it's mutually beneficial to them. Somebody might want cable and therefore have a service to get to it. But sure. this is more of a basis thing where it's, you know, if I am a hunter-gatherer tribe and I need people to go do hunting-gathering and there's a rival tribe next to me, if they have a way of hindering me, I'm probably not going to screw with them kind of scenario. I'm not going to invite a negative consequence, but it also might be beneficial in the sense that I don't want to screw with them because I could, and they're not going to screw with me, but they could, but it's mutually beneficial that we don't touch each other.
So are you saying that's where the root of the social contract lies?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's the idea that as long as we're benefiting in some capacity, which in this case, lack of threat
sure.
for both sides, not just one, because once you have only one, then there's no point. If they could hurt me and I can't hurt them, they're gonna come for us at some point because there's no benefit.
But what if the expenditures they have to surrender to hurt?
Oh, sure.
That's the other half of it.
There could be another balance.
Exactly.
Sure.
Is that, yeah, sure, they could, but is it worth their time?
Yep, or their resources.
Is the return worth their effort?
Yeah, so the question is losing their populace or... getting hurt in some capacity worth doubling their hunting grounds, right? You know, in a very simple way of sure. looking at it. But that's just it. I feel like that's kind of the thing is if, as long as the resources are equivalent across the board,
right?
You know, it takes me just as much effort to hurt you as it would for you to hurt me, then we're probably not gonna do anything because we're lazy by default, right?
It's kind of... go ahead.
Both sides of that work, right? There's no such thing as true altruism in my opinion. But there's also no such thing as true evil. No one does something just out of spite, just to hurt someone. Now, that's an interesting
debatable.
I know, right? But so is the lack of true altruism, right? There are a lot of people in this world, especially in the religious faith, that would say that true altruism exists because that's some of them have that as a foundational item, right?
Right. I mean, that would be, I mean, step in here, please, Jake. I mean, no, I was just going to say, I mean, I feel like that would be the exemplar of,
I mean, yeah,
sacrifice.
Effectively to boil. Oh wow, and we're getting into questions of like theories of atonement here, which is a whole fun topic. Like if you're ever interested in researching like Christology and Christianity, it's blown my mind in the last.
Leave a comment for Jake.
I love looking at this sort of stuff. But that's another topic for potentially our religion podcast once we finally get around to it. But yeah, I believe in altruism. I mean, altruism is exemplified in the Christ. You know, he who was perfect, who had no need to leave from the throne, from heaven, become like one of us and suffer for us instead. Mm-hmm. Like there was no social contract that would have required him to do this.
Not at all.
And so like that sort of altruism, that's kind of where I get the basis of that altruism does exist. Now, from a functional perspective of just looking at humanity, I can absolutely understand. Like, humans aren't great at being altruists.
No, we kind of suck at it.
A lot of it. Like, a lot. Yeah, I'll fully admit that myself. Like, sure, I do quote unquote good things, help the poor, donate, whatever. But how much of that is motivated out of guilt? Or, you know, like not truly completely altruistic because when I give to somebody, I feel better or less bad.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, you bring in a question of motives when you're talking about altruism.
Mm-hmm.
And if I give, you know, a homeless person $5, okay, I mean, that doesn't have a lot of manifest, tangible, good return for me. It's not an investment.
Right.
You're not expecting it to be an investment. But the magnitude of loss is so small, you don't really care that much.
Yeah.
But in return, you do get, you know, maybe you get the feeling like, hey, I help somebody out. That makes you feel good.
Yep.
And that's where it gets tricky, is because when you move away from a framework where you're talking about material returns on things,
sure,
then it's extremely subjective.
Mm-hmm. But are, you know, chemical processes in the brain not considered to be material returns?
I think they could. But they're still very subjective. Like,
sure.
There's a show I watch, really great show called Billions, and it's about hedge fund managers in New York, basically. And there's one episode where the young gun hedge fund manager is meeting with an older fund manager, and the older guy says, he's basically, imploring the young gunner to donate more.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the only thing that feels better than making it is giving it away. It's like, ooh, that's interesting.
Right.
I mean, even Andrew Carnegie said that, you know, the first third of your life, spend as much as you can learning. The middle third, spend as much as you can earning. The last third, spend giving away.
Mm-hmm. And like for me, that's something like coming from a very personal perspective. I struggled with the idea of altruism because I think it's something that we absolutely should strive for. Like, especially coming from my theology background. But I fully realize and fully accept that I often, more often than I would care to admit, and probably more often than I realize, do things out of quote unquote good works, out of obligation, or because it benefits me in some way. It could be monetarily, it could be I make friends, it could just be that it makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't have to be anything major, right? Like it just,
right.
But there is a return.
Right. And learning, like for me, while I still believe in altruism, like there's a lot of, it's not really taught in the Pentecostal world, which is where I really grew up, but it's kind of hinted at in some of the readings that I would do, where it's like, you know, if you gain something from helping somebody out, that's not an altruistic act. I would actually disagree with that. Just because you gain something doesn't mean that that was the original reason to do so.
True. I'll give you that. And that's the thing.
What if the gain for the other person is exponentially is the wrong word, orders of magnitude more in their favor than the gain you're going to get?
Sure.
Sure.
And it's like for me, ultimately my altruistic roots, I suppose, come back not just to Christ's sacrifice and resurrection itself, but also like his teachings, like give to the man, like if you have two shirts, give the man who has none one. And if a man strikes you, turn your other cheek. And that actually has a huge historical context, which is fun to get into, but it's basically inviting them to dinner when you do that and sort of a thing. And so it's like, and Christ, when he was speaking that, was, it's interesting because it's coming from, well, I read it as coming from a very altruistic thing. However, like a lot of scripture also understands kind of the human condition that we're talking about here. Like, you know, forgive and speak blessings over others because it will be like heaping coals on their head, which a lot of people take and misconstrue.
I love that.
And do
I love
things.
That.
Of course, Russ loves that.
Right. And it's, I mean, it's sometimes I use that sort of thing. Like we've talked about a couple of things on this podcast that I've mentioned, like, you know what, just do it because it's going to benefit you and benefit society. Like if we ever talk about socialism, whatever, sending money to the poorer classes, instead of giving it tax breaks to the rich elite or whatever, we should do it not just because it helps to lift people up and out of where they're at, but also because it boosts our economy. It boosts the overall wealth of even those richer people in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. But the, you know, unpopular opinion here, what do we do when we don't have the lower class? The middle class becomes the lower class.
Sure.
And that's, it's going to be an interesting little cycle, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're eventually going to be hitting a much more deeper existential question, I think, when automation becomes
absolutely
more mainstream.
So it's interesting. So altruism generally is, I guess, a morality-based clause.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is the truest good, right? It's doing good without getting anything in return.
Right. Or at least doing good without the motive of receiving. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Because, I mean, generally there's going to be some kickback regardless, because any type of action any type of action really will have a consequence, and it's not only a negative thing, but it'll have an outcome, right? Mm-hmm. It'll have an effect. And so it doesn't matter whether you benefit from it or not, that effect may benefit you. And even if you're not aware of it, then I consider that to be non-altruistic because it still benefits you, even if that's not what you're aiming for.
So you're framing altruism absent of intent.
Absent of intent, absolutely.
Interesting.
Because
which
it's
is
fun.
The way that I've always framed altruism as well. It's or at least for an act to be truly altruistic, it must be lacking in specifically selfish motive.
Absolutely. Now, what's fun is you flip that on its head, right? So let's invert the moral compass here.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing something specifically out of the goodness, specifically out of the evilness of the world,
So doing something to perpetuate evil?
Doing something that is perpetually evil
for no other reason than itself.
It is evil.
I think you're a sociopath at that point.
Well, that's what we label the potential psychotic side.
That
of it,
would
sure.
be psychopath, but yes.
Psychopath.
But it's interesting, right? Because we talk about altruism, and I don't know if there's a word for the other side of it.
A good question.
You know, we don't really...
Antonym of altruism. If you know what it is, leave a comment.
I do love the whole, like, scientific community, right?
Sure.
The idea that we measure things using one word, and that's about it. Like, we don't measure how cold something is.
We measure the absence of heat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we measure the absence of heat.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true.
And so I feel like we do a lot of that with wordplay, especially just in, like, the connotation of things like morals and ethics and whatnot. So we have altruism because we know what that is. We understand it. It's the positive force. But what is the lack of altruism?
Misanthropy?
I mean, it depends on, like, altruism is kind of a twofold thing. Like, sure. what is, which thing are we trying to prove is the opposite? And so many sources, my quick Google foo, seem to say that the opposite of altruism is actually selfishness.
I was going
to
say that.
The opposite is the motive,
wholly selfish act.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Which ruthlessness.
So how does selfishness, in your guys' opinion, how does that affect on the moral compass, right? So altruism we consider to be the ultimate good on the moral compass,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that's...
Sure. Let's look at it as a continuum.
Sure. But where does selfishness rely on that? Because I don't consider selfishness to be the pure opposite of that. I consider that to be the neutral side of that. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm not doing it for you, I'm doing it for me.
Well, let's frame it in that kind of transactional nature, because that's really what we're talking about.
Well, it seems to be the simplest way to describe it, right?
Exactly. We're talking about these things like, you know, giving a guy $5. Sure. You know, that's kind of a transaction, whether or not he's physically giving you something back. Yeah. Anyway.
But the selfish side of that is not giving him $5, right? Blatantly ignoring him.
Or would the selfish act be taking that $5
and burning it in front of him
and buying an ice cream cone and eating it in front of him?
See, and that I don't think consider is selfish. I consider that beyond selfish. I consider that
that's antagonistic.
So much
that that would be antagonistic,
right?
Maybe that's what I'm looking for. That's the other side that I'm looking for.
Maybe it's not an x-axis question,
and that's it. May not be a straight line.
I think it's a three-axis problem.
Yeah, I mean,
and when I say three axis, sorry Jake, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm trying to frame it here for people who can't crack open my head and see what's going on. You're welcome. You have, you know, we speak about these things in terms of a continuum. You know, like the opposite of love is not hate, but is apathy.
True.
So, but hate has to fall on there somewhere.
Sure.
Right.
If you're talking about a range of emotions, if you're talking about a range of acts or a motivation of those acts. If we say that giving a homeless person $5 with no strings attached, no conditions, no expectation of return, that would be pretty far in the altruistic corner.
Absolutely.
Just keeping that $5 in your pocket and walking by, I would say that's pretty neutral.
Yeah, it's pretty middle.
Maybe. But what if he really needs that $5?
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, that's where we get into like some of the hypothetical, like you have three people tied down to a train track.
I don't want to get into Tesla's autopilot logger. But no, the problem that presents is, okay, say that you don't give that person $5, but you donate that $5 to a church or something or to a charity.
Sure.
You know, you're not, that's not necessarily selfish.
I would say that is still on the same spectrum as giving it directly to him, you know, as long as there was no other connotation, right? I would say it's more an interesting thing that what if you took that money and donated it to a cause that was for specifically like anti-homelessness spikes on benches? Like,
that's just the other question. What if you took that money that would have gone to him and put it towards something that actively made his situation worse?
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. because I do feel mm-hmm. that selfishness really does end up in that neutral area. It's just, it's just for me. It's, I'm going to keep it.
But like, why, you know, unless you're a true misanthrope, I don't believe that it's completely impossible, but because I believe that, you know, finding an absolutely true altruistic human is incredibly difficult. I would also believe the same as the same of a misanthrope.
Right.
But, you know, like by and large, most of the times when I hear about, you know, folks wanting to put spikes down on park benches or whatever.
Well, they have good intentions.
Right. Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. If they do have good intentions, I think they're being incredibly short-sighted.
Sure.
Which is a whole other thing. But more often than not, when I hear about that sort of thing or getting the homeless out of our city sort of thing, it's not about wanting to cause the homeless harm, usually. It's more about I don't want to see the problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That is a very selfish motive.
I don't want to say that's the apathy side of it right there.
I mean, both. I mean, it can be both. I don't think
if it's not my problem,
exclusive.
It's not my problem, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. I mean, granted, there are the occasions, like, especially because I do work with the homeless population a little bit, and then I go back into the regular world, and I'll hear somebody talking about driving down Division Street or whatever. And there's somebody panhandling. Sometimes they're doing, there's like a median on one of those roads, and sometimes they're doing it on the median or whatever. And he's like, man, I just want to drive by and slam him with my door one of these days. I'm like, why?
Yeah.
That's not simply self. I think that is partly selfish, but I think that's actually much more towards the misanthropic antagonistic side. Yeah.
That's Schadenfreude at that point.
Yes.
Getting pleasure from someone else's suffering.
That's
maybe not.
I don't think Schadenfreude includes you causing it, though.
I don't think it excludes it. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Google man. I see what you're saying, though.
But it's interesting, right? Like, I can watch someone, you know, trip and fall and go, nah, you know, that's funny.
I can watch kids fall off bikes all day.
Exactly, yeah. Right? And I think is Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
Me causing someone pain, that's just, what, masochism?
Well, you, yeah, actually.
Misanthropy. Masochism would be causing yourself pain and
sadism.
Liking it.
Sadism.
A sadist gets pleasure from causing someone else pain.
Yes.
Okay. And so that's what I would think it would fall into as opposed to Schadenfreude.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
But that's just, it's an interesting thought, right?
Right.
Because yeah. I've never really viewed it as if I'm the one causing it, it's not really the same as me watching it happen.
Oh, it's not. But I just don't think that Schadenfreude excludes you causing the harm to someone. Okay. Schadenfreude.
I think the definition is simply taking pleasure in someone else's unfortunate.
Yeah, unfortunate circumstance. It doesn't say whether or not you caused the circumstance.
Fair.
I think there, like, we would use more specific language for either. Although Schadenfreude would be kind of by default most examples that I've seen, and
I think it's
probably
kind of
all the examples that I've seen.
It's the umbrella sentiment,
right? Sure. But all the examples that I've seen have been purely like situational that you were not a part of,
like watching Trump get absolutely hammered by the New York DA. I would love to see that.
It would be a little delicious. I shouldn't take pleasure in somebody else's pain, but...
when they bring it on themselves.
So
Lord,
it's interesting.
Lord
so
Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, and we'll figure it out.
Don't trip. He ain't through with me yet.
So dragging it back. So that is, in my opinion, a very moral construct, Schadenfreude. I don't consider that to be an ethical item in any way, shape, or form. I don't consider that to be a legal item in any way, shape, or form.
How so? I mean, the legal's a little bit, is pretty easy.
I mean, it's just way out there, right?
Right.
Ethical, I feel like, maybe from a social construct, like as a group of Christians, their ethical framework would say that Schadenfreude is incorrect, right? But as a, you know, myself sitting in an office with my local colleagues, we wouldn't necessarily say Schadenfreude is a bad thing because it doesn't really have any pertinence on our actual day-to-day lives. It's something that is ethically ambiguous, neutral, but... then morally, again, individually, it may or may not be within your own abilities to say that it's something that you should or should not be participating in.
I wonder what the element of distance, how the element of distance plays into this.
Absolutely.
Because I kind of equate it to lying. Like if you tell a lie, that is obviously, well, not obviously, but usually...
Sphere of influence kind of stuff?
What's that?
Sphere of influence kind of stuff where it's like, how far does it go?
No, not necessarily. So I'm thinking like, say your inaction cause someone else's mild suffering, but you got joy from that. Contrast that with your actions causing someone mild suffering. Now, are those the same thing? Are you a sadist if someone suffered because of you withholding assistance?
Inaction is an action, in my opinion.
That's true.
So we're quoting Gay Lee here. If you choose not to decide, you still made a choice.
You still made a choice. Yeah, absolutely. And I absolutely believe
Rush
that.
Reference! Oh, sorry. I was just going to go back to quoting James, but you know.
Whatever.
but it's like you have a point. If you sometimes actively chose to not do something that was within your power to do versus doing something that actively caused somebody harm, and it's the same amount of
versus
harm that
being
that person
out of
has.
Remove. Because if I watch kids fall off bikes on television,
sure,
I can't do anything about that. But I'm also not sticking.
Well, you have no power.
Yeah,
there,
and
right?
you're not close enough to the situation to prevent it.
Exactly.
So spirit of
I'm a completely neutral actor in that.
Right. I would. This is again coming from the more theological side of things. I would argue that most of the time, issues of the heart are more important than people realize. I would personally caution against too much schadenfreude. Now, again, I am subject to a lot of it because, like, from a purely theological point of view, yes, it's problematic. I think Christ calls us to a better standard within our hearts. However, also even from a society perspective, because as the more and more you lean into that, the more and more you enjoy other people's suffering. And I think that puts you on a momentum.
Oh, that was what I was going to bring up next is your action of simply observing it and enjoying it inching that needle closer towards a net negative?
Mm-hmm.
Very possible.
Just like stealing. Stealing might not be a great example, but holding a space in yourself for something that is a negative as a on a societal level, is that damaging?
I was going to say it's negative on a societal level.
Even if we are a tiny, tiny fraction of a society.
Sure. It's interesting because a lot of people put connotation positive or negative on a lot of things, words. Mm-hmm. I mean, great example I like using is the word cult.
Sure.
Cult has a negative connotation.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Christianity is a cult. It is a gathering of people who share like-minded ideas. That is the definition of a cult, by the way. It's fascinating, but it's such a negative stereotype that you associate with it. You would never call Christianity a cult.
Because often, like, and we don't even have to limit connotation to a purely emotional response. The dictionary term of cult might simply be a gathering of people with like mind.
That
but
could be anything.
Usually. Oh, yeah.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
That could usually be the three of us.
Oh, yeah.
Arguably, anyway, sorry, yes. I will stop.
We should buy robes.
I have
only one. If they're satin.
Why satin? Hail satin?
Because no, it feels comfy. Nice. God, Russ.
Yeah, that joke was wasted on you people. Someone out there who understands me, write in the comments.
Crickets.
I mean, we got what you were saying.
Oh, I understood it. I just didn't want to go along with
complete
it.
Inaction. I love it.
Sorry, Jake.
But even like splitting out the emotional reaction, like common parlance would say that cult is beyond just a gathering of people of like mind. Usually it includes a feature of exclusivity to those outside of the cult and indoctrination.
A fervent
indoctrination.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. But again, that is all connotation based on historical usage, I guess, is a good way to put
it. Sure, which I guess kind of breaks into our question of, like, what are the differences between legality, morality, and ethics? Yeah. I think it depends on who your audience is.
Absolutely.
And see, that's a really good segue, because when we're talking specifically about schadenfreude or, you know, just passing by a homeless person on the street, both legal.
Oh, yeah.
Totally absolutely. Legal. Mm-hmm. Now, are they moral?
Up to you. But that's a beautiful thing, right? It's your own compass.
That's true, because you could subscribe yourself to an ethic that does not consider those things immoral.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Or you could just subscribe to an ethic, we'll just throw out everybody's favorite punching bag, Ayn Rand, where, you know, helping the lower class or whatever is actually ethically bad.
Sure.
Because it, I forget it, her exact reasoning of it, but effectively from what I remember, it boils down to you're dragging the rest of the human race down and you're dragging yourself down.
I, Ayn Rand almost reads like satire to me. Just like, how can...
People believe it.
How can you, I know that's it's, the problem. I mean, like, how can you espouse such drastic...
It's a great foundation of capitalism.
It's a rather brutal foundation of capitalism.
Yes.
What's the fun thing about having your own beliefs, right? You, no one can necessarily tell you what your beliefs are. You have your own beliefs.
Right.
They are shaped by the world. They're shaped by the people you interact with and the people you were raised by, potentially.
Yeah.
It's shaped by your friends, your family, your coworkers. Even the environment you live in and the experiences you have shape your belief system. And that's the interesting part, because you can get these really extreme on both sides, right? You know, you have the person who lived in a city who had no homeless and never knew what really homeless was a thing. And then they came to a place that homeless existed, and they're like, oh, well, it's simple, right? You just pay the money, and they get better, and they go find homes and jobs, and they clean themselves up, and everything gets, you know, warm and fuzzy again, right? You know, the whole Norman Rockwell kind of idea. But
well, I don't think Norman Rockwell would have given them money, but yeah.
I know he's talking about an aesthetic.
Yeah.
The aesthetic, right? It is the perfect town.
Right.
Any perfect town, America.
Yeah. But then you look at people who grew up in, you know, large metropolitan areas, mm-hmm. in, you know, close proximity to the homeless areas, you know, areas where they tend to congregate. And those are the people that are more likely to be in another city and go, it's just homeless. It's normal.
Right. Or, and so, and it, I mean, even breaking down to the whole, like, there's a homeless guy on the road, you have $5 in your pocket.
Yeah.
What do you do? And there are a lot of people, especially in Christian circles, who would often say, don't give the money to the homeless.
They're just going to buy drugs. Yeah. You're not buying drugs for $5. No, I'll tell you that right now. Well, anyway.
Anyways. but even if you subscribe to that, which I had a good friend of mine also coming from the theology standpoint, is like, if you really believe in God, you should be able to believe in the redemption of that. But anyways, moving on. If you don't give that money directly to that person, that could be a morally positive inaction, I guess we'll call that. However, I would also argue that if that is your standpoint of like, they're just going to use it for drugs, are most cities, Spokane included, very included, have programs that you can donate to that help lift people out of homelessness without providing routes for getting drugs.
Sure.
I would at that point say that if you're not going to give that $5 to them, you're, I don't know that I'd necessarily say obligated to give it to one of those foundations, but if you don't, I don't think you can say that you're morally just in not giving it to the homeless person.
Sure. And I would equate giving it to the homeless person or giving it to an organization that assists with that area mm-hmm. is pretty equivalent. It's, in my opinion, it's providing a service for those kinds of people that may better themselves as opposed to them having the option to go do questionable things.
Mm-hmm.
I like that concept, but that also could just be the social, you know, side of me saying it makes me feel warm and fuzzy to actually give to an organization that I think is helping.
Sure.
As opposed to giving it to the person who may misappropriate it, which really shouldn't be a thing, because mm-hmm. corporations and the service groups have just as much of a chance to misappropriate these funds as the individual does.
I mean, we've seen it
over and over again, right? You know, it's not good. Mm-hmm. But that's just it for me. It's like, I generally don't give anything to homeless people, mainly because I don't have cash on me most of the time.
There's also that.
I have offered
Venmo to you.
I have offered food to homeless people, and I've been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, well, I can't buy, you know, alcohol with that. And I'm like, oh, well.
See, I've offered, all right. I've had people, homeless people approach me and say, can you spare a couple dollars for a meal?
Sure.
I said, I don't have any cash, but there's a restaurant over there.
Let's get you a meal.
I'll go buy you a burger.
Yeah.
And they didn't really know what to do with it.
They get confused.
okay, you want to disarm someone real quick? Offer to buy them a burger.
There you go.
And it worked. I mean, you know, burger, fries, here's your box, there you go.
Well,
you know?
I feel like that's actually helping, in my opinion, mm-hmm. right? Like, that makes me feel that it's actually going to a good place. They've got a good meal for the day.
Right.
You know, I feel warm and fuzzy, you know.
Sure.
For myself.
Right. And I mean, the topic of homelessness, man, I feel like that's actually an episode that I would love to do. And I'd love to get a couple of, you know, the folks that I work with downtown. But that also kind of, like, I feel like we've touched on this idea a little bit, but let me bring it out into the open. I mean, and Russ, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this specifically because you don't believe in true altruism. Because
he's a robot.
I'm an alien.
Uh-huh.
It's a difference.
So you're alien masquerading
as a
robot, about.
Masquerading as a human.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Layers.
That's like H.P. Lovecraft and Philip K. Dick.
I'm here for it. I'm very here for it.
I would not be opposed to be called an elder god. I'm okay with this.
I would be opposed to that.
I have questions on, like, you know, if you know, the reality or the veil of reality was torn asunder and Cthulhu climbs through, like, would it actually be so incomprehensible that I'd be driven insane?
No.
I just feel like after it'd last be a year, normal no. Tuesday, man.
Hey, that's how you see, and oh, this cracks open a lot of questions. When you are thrust into a completely absurd and completely foreign scenario of reality, whether that's Cthulhu or whether that's the employer for whom you used to work just going completely off the rails, does embracing the chaos bring with it any, as a function of survival, bring with it any moral quandaries?
Ooh,
I like that.
Interesting.
Like, say let's talk Mad Max, because everybody's seen Mad Max.
Sure.
Great movie, whether the first one or the most recent one. You know, if you match the reality that you live in,
well,
does that start to violate ethical or moral bounds?
Well, see, morals, I think, are very manipulatable.
Subjective.
Malleable.
Subjective. Fungible.
Fungible. Like, there's a lot of fun words, right?
Yeah. Words.
I consider morals to be very not set in stone. You're going to change your morals throughout your life based on the experiences you have. And again, it goes back to the whole, like, what you've been brought up on and whatnot. And I feel
are
like
morals subject to situation.
I think they are. And I think
situational morality
specifically based on you.
I debated this in college.
Interesting. But I feel like ethics is more of the ground rules and framework of either the society, the business you're part of, whatever the social group is that you're part of. But those are set for you effectively, as opposed to you dictating yourself. Fair. And then of course, legality is more of the governance setting for its rule.
Codified ethical framework.
Codified ethical framework. Something that's actually tangible and structured in such a way that it isn't easily changeable, but yet enforceable.
Enforceable.
And that's kind of the structure that I envision when I think of morality, ethics, and legality.
Right. Well, kind of getting back to my original question, it was, I'm wondering, can an act be truly good without being truly altruistic?
Yeah, absolutely.
Unpack that.
So I guess the question kind of begs, like, which ethical framework we're subscribing to is, like, the motivation, does a motivation for an action have a effect on the, I guess, the qualification of its outcome?
So maybe I'm oversimplifying here, but if you do a bad thing for a moralistic reason, does that amplify or reduce that bad thing?
And the opposite of that too, right? Like, if I do a good action that benefits everybody, but I do it more out of a selfish motive than anything,
sure.
is that action completely tainted?
Sure.
Bro, people spent 4,000 years debating this.
And we're still here. That. Yeah.
We are probably not going to find an answer tonight.
And I would say
Aristotle didn't have scotch. I'm just going to say that.
No, I think they just drank toilet wine.
Oh, it was. I don't know.
They just waited until things started to grow mold or rot or turn fizzy. And they tried drinking a whole bunch of things. And I think a lot of people died before we got scotch and beer.
True.
Fair. No, Egyptians had beer back like thousands years ago.
Doesn't mean a lot of people didn't die trying random fermented stuff.
That is entirely true. That is entirely true. Sorry, back to the topic.
Anyways, I would argue that the reason behind an action doesn't taint the action for anyone except the actor.
Well, you got to remember the action and the whether it is classified as an altruistic act really lies in the perception mm-hmm. of the group that's viewing it, right? I can hand you $10 right now, and Mr. Griff over here might consider that to be truly altruistic because he has no idea about the context.
Right.
I'm just giving you $10.
I'd say,
for no apparent reason.
That's interesting. I would assume that Jake, you know, translated a Word document into a PDF
for you. So there's an assumption that I can't be altruistic.
Can I get $10 for that?
I don't have $10.
Damn it.
It's more like 50 anyways. But it's interesting that Griff, even as his own admission, would say that obviously I have an ulterior motive.
Mm-hmm.
That's because we've spent hours talking about how you don't believe there's true.
Sure, and we're also at that point bringing observational subjectivity into it. And
sure.
That's not really what I'm getting at. I'm just like the pure, and I mean, I don't think this is really honestly measurable.
Well, that's the problem, right?
And that's kind of what it breaks down into. And it's like it's interesting, especially talking about, you know, universal code of ethics or whatever, Kant deontology sort of stuff. Coming from again a theological point of view, there's some basis to say exactly what you said is like an action can be quote unquote completely good. At least by and large, while the motives could be wrong. And there's something to the St. Paul writes something to the effect of, I don't care if people are preaching about Christ because of selfish motives, basically, so they can get money from people.
Yeah.
I just care that Christ is being preached. And so,
really, he's saying the thought doesn't count.
Yeah.
At least not to the greater action. Now,
well, the end goal, right? The ends justify the means is what I'm hearing.
Now, here. See, here's a really interesting here's a really interesting modernization of that is that just recently there was a group of like Fortune 500 CEOs who rallied behind Jamie Dimon of all people, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, and signed this corporate citizenship resolution, basically. And I mean, in a nutshell, broadest of strokes, says, you know, we're going to start thinking about the stakeholders, not just the shareholders. We're going to start thinking about our impact on the community. Now, that's a net positive, you know. It has a vast potential to be a net positive. That's also going to be good for their business.
Oh, yeah, it's called a PR stunt.
I mean, that's the thing.
Oh, is, absolutely, yeah.
It is a PR stunt, even if it is transparently self-interested, but still has a net positive for society.
Yeah.
Now, I guess the question is, are we so cynical as, and I'm not saying the three of us, I'm just saying as a, you know, we live in a society. Are we cynical enough to the point where we reject that because we feel it is just a PR stunt?
I think a lot of people...
I think we're getting there.
Yeah, we are. I think a lot of people would rather not know. And they would rather assume
mm-hmm.
that it's a completely altruistic effect of a company to be like, oh, we're going to benefit our
local
community.
Like they just started doing it of their own volition.
Exactly. And it's not because of anything on the back end, like someone didn't have a problem. There wasn't like legality involved. There wasn't anything else. It's just, oh, they've decided to be better people.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like as a society, we strive for that. Like that's what we want. Like we don't want to know about the dirty little secrets in the corner. We just want everyone to get along, everyone to be happy. And it's interesting, like... The old motto, or the old, was it the motto? Somewhere in the bylaws of Google, it said, do no evil.
Mm.
And I loved that.
And then they
removed
it.
Yeah, they removed it. They made it more sense. They made it more sensible. They actually took a more mature approach to their bylaws and actually made it more of a corporation and more, less fun.
What does it say? It sounds like you were leading up to telling us what it actually says.
They just removed that particular clause.
Right.
And it was... Of course, a lot of us who kind of rallied behind that is just you guys are a huge mega corporation, but one of your bylaws is do no evil, and now you've removed that. What does that mean?
It means you're going to be Amazon.
They already are.
The Googlezon is coming. I want to tell you this right now.
Googlezon?
Mm-hmm. Googlezon is coming. This is a fantastic video back in like 2007. Mm. Go check it out on YouTube. Go search for Googlezon.
Portents of doom.
And it is amazing because they predicted like 95% of it. And the only thing that hasn't happened is them merging together to become the ultimate
info. I think the federal government may step into that point.
I wouldn't even.
They're already looking hard right now.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, it brings back to mind the whole thing that happened with Microsoft and Internet Explorer back in the 90s.
Did anything happen with Internet Explorer back in the 90s?
Actually, yeah. Basically, if memory serves, and Russ, you probably recall this much better than I do, they said that Microsoft can't only allow Internet Explorer to be the only browser on the Windows platform.
Specifically that, because they always did allow other browsers.
Sure.
It was the fact that you couldn't uninstall Internet Explorer. Mm. It was pre-installed and had to be part of it because it was actually part of the OS. It was actually the Explorer.
Yes,
So they added the option to uninstall Explorer, which actually all it did was remove the primary link for Internet Explorer. That was it. Right. All the DLL files and everything else still exists because it has to.
Well, it's Windows is such a god-awful spaghetti of libraries. It's terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
But anyways, I feel like we're getting off topic.
So getting back to corporations. So corporations are treated as entities in our governance, right, within mm-hmm. our legal system. I don't feel that corporations generally have a moral compass. I don't necessarily feel that they themselves have morality. Now, the people running them, sure. The board of directors, mm-hmm. sure.
The mission of that corporation.
The mission of the corporation. But I feel that's more ethical. It's the guidelines that they have set forth by themselves to say that we are not going to do evil in the case of, you know, Google. Or we have a requirement to uphold and better our local communities. That's more of an ethical thing, in my opinion, rather than a morality type issue.
Sure. I mean, because that is a framework of conduct.
It is. And they expect their employees and anyone associated with them to adhere to that framework.
Right.
Thus, I think it's the major difference between the morality and the ethics of it all.
Mm-hmm.
That's a true. That hurt my brain a little bit. I keep coming back to Bill Gates, to Daddy Billy.
Sure. Uncle Can you Billy. Not call him that ever?
Yeah, because it's
call
him Daddy Gates.
Yeah, that, Daddy Gates.
Is it Daddy Gates?
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought it was Daddy Elon.
Daddy Elon, Daddy Gates.
Yeah.
We have multiple daddies.
Oh, yes.
This is weird.
Many daddies.
Where's Bezos fit in this?
Bezos
he's
is...
Just
now,
Jeffy
he's
B.
Jeffy B.
Jeffy yeah. B, yeah. See, it's kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald. I can't speak today. I'm not drinking, I swear. It's the people who have questionable morals don't get to be called fun names.
I would argue that Musk, Bezos, and Gates all have questionable motives.
But see, this
Gates is probably the least questionable. But the perception
is that Gates is the altruist.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Elon's the eccentric, and Bezos is the devil.
Definitely Lex Luthor.
Lex Luthor.
Yeah. See, I think Musk is a chaotic evil.
Oh, I love him. I think he's chaotic good.
I'd say chaotic neutral.
I don't see good.
I love the fact that we all agree it's chaotic.
Yeah, there's no way because it's not.
He's a millennial billionaire.
Yeah.
He has subjective moral compass.
Is he a millennial?
It doesn't matter whether or not he is a millennial. He identifies.
That's true.
And that's the thing, too. You know, speaking to a generation, you don't have to be part of that generation.
Fair.
I do think it's a head scratcher with Gates though, because he's extremely wealthy and he got wealthy by being completely
just
ruthless.
You don't get rich,
but now
by following the rules,
by and large, yeah.
Ayn Rand.
Well, most Fortune 100 company CEOs and founders, generally, if they're making billions, they are sociopaths. They have to be.
There's
no way that you can handle the weight of the people that you potentially are putting out of business, that you are potentially causing joblessness or poverty. You can't.
And that's unfortunate. And that's the thing. And maybe Gates is trying to atone for this. Maybe he realizes it. And is that maybe they're driven so selfishly that they don't care. Like, I don't care how much destitution and misery my venture causes. It's a net positive for me, therefore I'm going to do it. Or
take it a step further. What if it's a net positive for the community?
Well, that was my other point is mm-hmm. what if they see misery has a very outsized connotation. What if they see that misery that they're causing as just the tuition of a bigger, better
absolutely the trade-off
end goal?
Right?
Yeah.
The telos, which is the greater good. It's like we were saying earlier, if you want to make an omelet, you got to crack some eggs, you know? Gates is in particular, because he's very publicly philanthropic.
Absolutely.
You know, but he's spent so much of his life just being ruthless and commandeering and monopolistic. Mm-hmm. And now he's got hundreds of billions of dollars
and he's using it for the greater good. Way.
Right.
It's like, is he truly taking the Andrew Carnegie approach, or is he trying to atone for something? Or is he like, you know,
and in my
I just
opinion,
can't spend all of this, so I'm going to give it away and hopefully sanctify myself in the people's consciousness.
And in my opinion, that is the...
Damn, that got heavy. I'm sorry.
It does that. In my opinion, that's where the lack of true altruism really exists, right? It does feel like a lot of these people who, especially later in life, as you kind of said, the whole thirds thing, when they're giving back, it's because they've taken so much beforehand. Now, it's not to say that it's not a net positive on the group as a whole, whether it be the society or otherwise, but it does feel like we tend to, I don't know, kind of glaze over some of the evils of the past because they're doing good things now.
Well, see, this dovetails extremely well into the conversation that's been raging about removal of Confederate statues and of just historical statues in general.
Absolutely.
Like when you assign a shared memory of someone to that person. Now we can let's use Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederate States of America, in opposition to George Washington. Okay, both owned slaves.
Sure,
both perpetuated that horrific cycle. But we are not nearly as eager to tear down George Washington's statue as we are to tear down Jefferson Davis's statue.
Though we are moving towards that as a public consciousness.
I was going to say true equality, right?
What?
If you can't have one, you can't have the other.
I think you can.
Really?
Because Jefferson Davis, his whole being is assigned and written upon the institution of slavery.
Sure.
All he's known for, that's all he will be known for, is trying to uphold the institution of slavery and subjugation of a whole race of people, mm-hmm. which is moralistically abhorrent.
Sure.
Now, George Washington on their hand, or Jefferson. I don't really like Jefferson, so we won't get into that. Or we could even use Lincoln.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Like Lincoln, we post as one of the top three presidents ever, along with Washington. But he was horrifically racist. And there's a lot of research, historical evidence, whatever, coming out now that said he really only freed the slaves to help fight the war. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't care what happened to him after the war was over. He cared about saving the Union by any means necessary. And if that meant granting 4 million black people freedom, great. Freaking do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
See, so that's
true altruism, right out the window.
What's that?
True altruism, absolutely. Completely out the window.
That is not, you know, Lincoln being this man ahead of his moralistic time. He was very much in his moralistic time. But we don't tear down his monuments because of that. You know, so I think you ask, what are these people known for and what will their story be? In Jefferson Davis's case, it's perpetuating slavery. In Lincoln's case, it's preserving the Union. In Washington's case, it's establishing the Union. And we're willing to forgive a lot of sins.
Yes.
If we feel that the overall contribution of that individual is a net positive for society as a whole.
Sure. There's also, I think, a tinge of the victor tends to write the history books in that one as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
You know, I'm sure there were...
Not even the victor. I mean, just the local governance.
Well, yeah, whoever came out of it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. whoever's still there to write the book.
Right. And I mean, like a lot of history books in the South still say that it was all about states' rights.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Daughters of the Confederacy. Blame them. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, technically... I mean, if you want to get legalistic about it, yeah, it was about states' rights. .. To own slaves.
Yes. Yes.
Let's get that out on the table right now.
So, in closing.
Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Ethics, morality, legality. Legality seems to be the less controversial, mm-hmm. I guess is the word.
Really?
It's black and white. It either exists as a law or it doesn't. You're either violating it or you're not. Now,
see,
interpretation.
That's a recipe for controversy, though.
Right. Whether or not something should be a law is a separate question.
Oh, yeah. Whether it should be or not, sure. But laws exist, and there are ways to either follow them, skirt them, or otherwise. But when it comes down to it, we have a system in place, specifically the court system, that dictates whether something is legal or not. We don't have that in place for ethics, necessarily. We have boards, ethical boards, sure. But we don't necessarily have a morality police.
Thank God. But laws and legal frameworks are not independent of their constituents and of their creators who are by necessity human. That's what's so confounding, is that the outcome, the end point of the legal system spear can and has rested on 12 people. And those 12 people can be given to different moral compasses dependent on not only the time, but the geographic location. As we just saw with the trial of Derek Chauvin, guy who killed George Floyd, who now has by our legal definition, killed George Floyd. Mm-hmm. See, that's what's so interesting. This is a whole different episode. I'm sorry. Tune in next time.
It's beautiful. I love it.
That's my closing thought, Jake. Sorry to dump that on your
lap. No, you're good. You're good. As to like the original sort of kind of question to the episode, altruism, true altruism. Yeah.
I think it was more of just we were having a discussion about ethics versus ethics morals and legality.
Laws, morals, and ethics. Oh, my. Can we name that? That's kind of the title. Name,
yeah.
Title. That's the title.
Yeah. As far as, you know, other outstanding questions, I suppose, I certainly still believe in true altruism. I think it's something to strive for. I think it is something that I have not achieved yet. Maybe in very small aspects of my life, but arguably not in the whole.
I think it exists on a spectrum. The closer you get to the purely altruistic end of that spectrum, the better off you're probably going to be.
Absolutely.
Even though you may not ever, it's like Plato said, we will never achieve perfection, but that does not mean we should not aspire to it.
I do not claim to have finished the race. I am still running it. Yep.
Yeah. Don't trip. He ain't through with me yet.
So getting, as we have now officially finished our episode, we should get into our Scotch break.
This is your regularly scheduled Scotch break.
So this week we are still drinking Ainslie Bray, which is a single malt whiskey. And do you know what single malt means?
Yeah, it means it's unadulterated. It means it's come from one type of grain. It's not a blend. It's not Johnny Walker.
Well, that's correct. It's not a blend.
That's a very crude explanation.
A little bit, because there are much better blended whiskeys and scotches.
I refuse to acknowledge any blended scotch as a scotch. That's because I'm an elitist jerk.
I also feel like you don't know enough of what you're talking
about.
No,
I probably don't, but that's fine.
Because neither of us do. Eh. So a single malt is actually, it is something that's blended, but it's blended together from a single distillery and has been aged for 3 years or more with an ABV of over 40%. And it must have also been distilled in copper pot stills.
I think there is a legal definition of single malt scotch, mm-hmm. just like there's a legal definition of champagne.
Yep,
and champagne, sparkling wine that does not come from the Champagne region of France is not champagne.
Right. Same sort of ideas with scotch. So there's actually kind of a spectrum, you could almost say. Scotch can be a blend which is made from one or more single malts or more single grain whiskeys from distant distillers. And a blended malt is similar to that, but it's a mix of single malts that have been distilled at more than one distillery.
So why does there seem to be preference given to single malts? Like if you go buy a bottle of a single malt scotch, it will probably cost you more than an equivalent blended scotch. That's the question. I don't know. I'm genuinely asking. If you know, leave us a comment.
So one of the biggest things is actually that blended whiskeys can use other things other than barley. So a blended whiskey can contain corn, rye, and even wheat as their base.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Why does that reduce their rhetorical impact?
It's actually faster to produce and costs less money.
Ah, so it's the cheap way out. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Stoli vodka for when you just want to get drunk.
And vomit.
Hashtag not sponsored.
Not at all. We ground up potatoes and mix them with paint thinner. Here you go. Stoli, it's for breakfast.
They had to use a really specific type
of plastic.
We're going to get in
trouble.
It was going to
He's
going to
cut that, I'm sure.
We'll see. So anyways, thank you everybody for listening to this episode. It was a lot of fun to talk about morality and ethics and really light subjects like that. Please leave us a comment on our website, scotchandsocialism.com. Come follow us on social media. Look for Scotch Socialism on Instagram and Twitter. And we hope to hear from you soon.